¿Quieres mejor internet? Cox Internet de 300 megas tiene las velocidades rápidas y confiables que buscas. Perfecto para streaming y gaming y trabajar desde casa. Todo por solo $45 al mes cuando agregas Cox Mobile. Incluye equipo de Wi-Fi y garantía de precio de 2 años en tu plan. No esperes. Cámbiate hoy a Cox. Requiere Cox Mobile Gig Unlimited. Garantía de precio no incluye impuestos y cargos. Velocidad de datos móviles se reduce después de 20 gigas al mes.
Hi, and welcome back to Activists of Tech, the Responsible Tech Podcast. After Trump was elected and tech oligarchs like Elon Musk, an unelected person, started to get power in decision-making at the White House, the topic of techno-fascism got very popular. But this political trend of leveraging technology to empower fascist ideologies is nothing new. A lot has been written about techno-fascism in the 21st century, but I wanted to go back to the basics. What is fascism before technology? How do fascist movements use technology to take power, and what kind of power dynamic is created? And most importantly, how can we resist the rise of techno-fascism? To answer these questions and more, I am welcoming Dr. Emil Dirks. Emil is a senior research associate at the Citizen Lab at the University of Toronto, where he explores Chinese politics and digital authoritarianism. His work on biometric surveillance in China has been covered by The New York Times and The Economist, among other publications, and he's the co-author of a forthcoming book on how China governs its diaspora. Exploring in depth fascism and its repercussions can be depressing, but Emil actually ended with a very strong message of hope, inclusion, and solidarity. So make sure you stay until the end. Hi, Emil. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So can you bring everyone up to speed and explain what is fascism from a political science perspective?
Sure. So I think probably the simplest way to think about it is fascism is a vision of political power, and it's also a subcategory of authoritarian politics. So in the same way, there are lots of different varieties of socialism or democracy or capitalism. We can think of there being varieties of authoritarianism. So we could ask, okay, what makes fascism different from other kinds of authoritarian politics? I think what differentiates fascism is really a particular worldview that's violent, hierarchical, exclusionary, and anti-modern. So really, if we're thinking about how does a fascist look at the world that we're in right now, I mean, they would look at a world characterized by diversity and difference and feel nothing but fear. They'd look at a world in which the weak, the vulnerable, the poor, the disabled are cared for and feel contempt. They'd look at immigrants not as a source of strength, but as a kind of biological pollution of a racial community. They'd look at people possessing equal rights and instead want social hierarchies to be reinforced and even undeserving people to be stripped of their rights. They see democracy not just as something that's reflecting the people's will, but actually impeding it. And instead, they want a leader to stand above it all and be a voice for this people. And finally, I think it really is important to mention that they're obsessed with violence. I think one of the real central appeals of fascism is a kind of sadistic thrill of watching others suffer. So in many ways, violence is not only a way of achieving the goals of a fascist movement, violence itself is a goal. Fascist movements want to create societies in which enemies are punished, mocked, despised, and even killed, sometimes just as a spectacle for the sheer thrill of it. I think the other thing to mention as well is that we often think of fascists in terms of fascist states. And I think today we'll be talking a lot about fascist states. You know, we think about Nazi Germany, fascist Italy. However, I think what we need to remember is fascist movements are social movements, right? And those kinds of social movements can actually pre-exist a fascist state. Fascist movements can exist within a country where the state itself isn't fascist. So you think about even the Italian and German fascist movements, they predated their own seizure of power, right? So fascist movements are kind of often just waiting in the wings, waiting for that opportunity to rise up and seize power, seize control of the state, and turn the state over to their own purposes. And finally, I think another thing to mention as well is that to succeed, fascists don't actually need the support of the majority of the population. Again, I think there's this kind of common sense of what, say, Nazi Germany or fascist Italy were like, where you think of just this completely unified population backing the fascist state. And so we tend to assume that when it came to power, these fascist movements were also backed by an overwhelming majority of the population. But actually, fascist movements, whether in the past or today, they actually don't need the support of the majority of the people to take power. Instead, fascists really, what they want, what they need is to convince key constituencies of people, key constituencies within society to back them. Things like segments of the middle class, powerful business interests, key media platforms, or even existing right-wing or conservative parties. They want to be able to convince this kind of plurality or even just this minority of groups that, hey, there is no alternative to fascist rule, or the fascists are the ones who are best positioned to protect the interests of those groups against, say, left-wing political parties. Oddly enough, fascists often win power through the ballot box, right? It's not always a violent revolution that brings the fascists to the fore. They often are competing in elections and then winning, if not winning a majority of the votes, and again, a plurality of the votes. And yet, despite coming into power through the ballot box, fascists are committed to eroding democracy, eroding democratic norms, eroding liberal values. And they're looking not only to take control of the state, but can take control of the state bureaucracy, to staff it, not with people necessarily who are competent, but people who are loyalists. And so when we're thinking about fascism, we're thinking about those core values, that worldview that it has, the way that it tries to take power slowly creeping up through existing power structures. I think what we're really thinking of is fascism taking control of a society like a cancer, like slowly metastasizing the body of democratic states until the entire system of government, the entire society bears the weight of this tumor.
You talked about social movements and key constituencies. What about tech movements? Because while you were explaining, I kept having the faces of tech oligarchs pop in my head. How does technology enable and empower fascism? And what are the signs we should be looking out for?
Yeah, so I think if we think about fascism today, or also we can think about fascism back in the early 20th century when it rose, and in that time period, fascism was also very tied to the technologies of the time. So if we're looking at fascism in the early 20th century, what were the kind of technologies that they were looking to use to ride to power and to hold power once they'd taken control of the state? And as often, you think of the big industrial production, the factories of those times, and also mass communication like radio and film. So thinking of Nazi Germany, industrial production, the Nazi movement was looking to make inroads to the with the industrial class, the industrial business class at that time, because they had both the money and political capital that the Nazis needed to take power, but also they had the systems of economic production, that the Nazi movement needed in order to do things like wage wars of conquest in Europe, build up the architecture of a fascist state, and ultimately build the kind of industrial killing factories of the Holocaust, right? We can also think at the same time of the fascist movement's embrace of radio and film as a way of providing them with platforms to propagate their particular hateful views to the public. So when we're thinking of fascist power in the 21st century, we're also thinking about what are the technologies of the moment? What are the ways that fascists today are looking to use the kind of new or emerging technologies to seize power, to hold power, to propagate views? And so, whereas fascism in the early 20th century was very much industrial production, radio and film, I think now what we're seeing is an embrace of things like social media, techniques and tools of biometric identification, big data and AI-enabled systems that can classify and track the individuals or the activities of individuals and whole communities. And so before getting into that, I think one of the things also to keep in mind is that if we scratch the surface of these tools and technologies, again, big data, social media, et cetera, we find that the actual aims of 21st century fascists are just as crude and destructive as their 20th century predecessors. So what we're really seeing is the application of new tools, new technologies being put to old ends.
Could you give us an example?
Well, we could think of the algorithmic forms of policing that seek to collect or purchase huge amounts of data on individuals within a country, comb through this data looking for patterns or notable anomalies, and then using all this data to classify people, classify them for the purpose of heightened surveillance, a detention, deportation, and potentially even death. Now, it's important to note that when we're thinking about these, say, algorithmic forms of policing, these are not tools that were developed with the fascist political project in mind, right? These are tools that predate the emergence of fascist politics within a particular polity, right? Many of these tools, algorithmic policing tools, were developed for quote unquote normal policing work, or for border security, or for overseas military operations, or counterterrorism. What we find, however, with 21st century fascism is that these very tools, they're embraced by this authoritarian political movement. The more that they're embraced, the more there's a tendency to actually expand the realm in which these forms of control and surveillance are used. And why is that? It's because it's in keeping with this fascist desire to bring more and more of society under the disciplining power of the state, and to further exclude and punish those who don't fit in with this fascist vision of a perfect society. So, independent of the emergence of fascist movements, societies are full of exclusionary or hierarchical systems of organization, right? There are people who get the benefit of the law, other peoples who find themselves outside of it. So groups that are already marginalized within democratic societies, they can be subjected to even more harsh and invasive forms of surveillance and control. So I think one of the examples we're seeing right now in the United States is how immigration and customs enforcement agents, ICE agents, are reportedly using mobile facial recognition tools as a way of identifying or confirming the identity of individuals who may later be subject to detention and deportation. So those kind of tools, the facial recognition tools, ways of categorizing migrants or citizens, these predate the emergence of, say, a fascist movement that's taking rapid control of the United States. But they're being seized upon, they're being used by that fascist movement for the particular ends of that movement. We think of these new forms of control, and oftentimes they can be seen in sort of bloodless terms, you know, this kind of algorithmic policing, this use of big data for the purpose of classifying or
Yeah.
controlling people. But these advanced forms of control, they don't replace brutal violence. They actually complement it. They reinforce it, right? They are not something that actually stands to one side. They intermingle with those more brutal forms of state control. And I think the other thing to think of as well is, you know, I mentioned the 20th century, the use of film and radio by fascist movements to propagate their vision. I think social media, we can't forget the role that social media has played as a vector for fascist organizing and fascist propaganda. If we're looking at the roots of 21st century fascism, be it in North America or Western Europe. What we're really seeing is those roots are on websites, are on social media platforms, are on message boards. I think it's here rather than, say, in print media or broadcast media necessarily. It's on these kind of social media platforms, these online spaces, where we really see the ideology of 21st century fascism being cultivated, and the minds of young men and women being radicalized. So long before these fascist movements were able to integrate themselves into electoral politics, the politics of fascism were playing out in those spaces. And so what we see there is social media is permitting and even encouraging the creation of transnational fascist movements, people in a variety of different countries sharing common grievances and narratives of political power. And those narratives often are focused on things like disdain for marginalized groups, like migrants or racial or ethnic or religious minorities or the undeserving poor or LGBTQ people. There's also conspiratorial narratives about sinister plots by hidden forces seeking to rule the world, valorization of traditional values, including patriarchal or sexist ideas about the role of women. And, you know, I think if all this sounds familiar, this is the kind of stuff that Elon Musk's X is promoting, right? Not only, but there's a good
Yeah.
example of how those platforms are being used to push this stuff. Just to emphasize this point is that 21st century fascist movements, yes, they're seizing on the technologies of the moment, but their vision of politics is really backwards looking, right? They talk, or they often will dress themselves up in the technology, the new tools of the day. But really what they're looking to do is reclaim a past in which they believe social hierarchy was respected, borders were protected, women were homemakers, minorities knew their place, everyone loved their country. Now, the fact that this such a past never existed in the first place is totally irrelevant. Fascists want to use the tools of today, the technologies of today, to create that kind of backwards-looking vision of society. Now, they'll fail to do this, as all fascist movements have failed. You cannot recreate, you cannot create that kind of society. It will fail. But that doesn't mean that the ambitions of the fascists can be dismissed. Simply in trying to achieve this particular vision of society, fascists will tear democracies apart, they'll brutalize the weak, and they will fundamentally degrade the values of empathy and tolerance that are just so core to a functioning civil society.
I find it so paradoxical that technological advancements just make us go backwards, politically speaking, because of these fascist movements. And I did not prepare actually a question on social media, but what do you think is the responsibility of social media stakeholders when it comes to democracy? Like, what do they owe our democratic societies?
Well, I think for one, and this seems like such a base requirement, but again, as Elon Musk's X kind of indicates, I think a base requirement for social media platforms is not to actively promote this kind of material. This is not to say that prior to Musk taking over X, X was some, or Twitter, as it used to be called, was some kind of paragon of virtue, right? However, we've seen under Musk how a social media platform can go from simply maybe tolerating certain kinds of hate speech to actively promoting it, actively stripping away the safeguards that would lead to the reach of this kind of hateful speech being limited, right? So I think one of the fundamental base level requirements of any social media platform is to put in place some kind of content moderation that prevents this kind of material from being spread. And certainly prevents people from being subjected to targeted digital harassment by fascists or other hate groups. I think that, again, seems like a fairly limited ask. It seems just so simple an ask as to be almost silly. But again, we've seen this under Musk, just how quickly a platform can actually move into becoming a megaphone for these kind of hateful views when the ownership of that platform actually, in many cases, shares those views.
Yeah, you work mostly on China. Do you see parallels with what is currently happening in the United States between the use of technology for mass surveillance and tech oligarchs going beyond lobbying and being in government like Elon Musk? Like, I know China uses mass surveillance, but it's branded in a way, and I don't know much about it. Like, you can, for instance, just pay for stuff just by scanning your face, and like, you know, the government knows where you are at any moment if you're in a big city. Is that right?
Well, certainly the Chinese state has put a lot of time, money, and energy into building a surveillance state that's capable of identifying, tracking, and ultimately controlling individuals who they see as a threat to social stability. Now, those groups can include dissidents, activists, members of persecuted religious or ethnic minority communities, but it can also include a lot of the same groups who are subjected to similar kinds of surveillance. In democratic states. So, people in community corrections, users of drugs, people with mental health issues, etc. So, one of the things I think to think about is that when we're thinking about policing, whether it's in authoritarian states, including fascist states, democratic states, there's often this blurring of crime control and political control, right? We often tend to think, okay, in a state like China, the police are obsessed with political control. And in a state like, say, the United States or Canada, they're focused more on crime control. Actually, these things get blurred. There's a lot of blurring there. I think there's a tendency also to view China as almost being the polar opposite of the United States, right? Or China is somehow tending towards a kind of authoritarian future that other states like the United States needs to avoid. But actually, I think if we're looking at the operations of both of those states, if we're looking at the operation of authoritarian forces in China or in the United States, say the police, for instance, their ultimate goal to me looks actually very similar, certainly as someone who studies China. Ultimately, I think their goal is to collect as much information on as many people as possible and then determine what to do with it later. To collect a lot of data and use it for the purpose of surveillance and control over a range of groups in society. I think what differentiates the two countries is actually how they're getting there. So in the United States, there's nominally limits on the ability of state actors, say the police or others, to collect whatever kind of data they want from whoever they want. Now, I'm speaking in ideal terms, or I'm speaking kind of abstractly, but generally speaking, that's the case. And so what we find in the United States is that oftentimes, even before Trump, police were, say, looking to buy data off of from data brokers, work through social media platforms, use kind of that data in order to get data on individuals that they couldn't collect, where they couldn't collect data from them directly, right? And one of the reasons for that is there are stricter controls on the ability of state actors to collect data in the United States, less strict controls on the ability of, say, companies to collect and store and process and share lots of kind of data. In China, it's kind of the reverse. Actually, you see, oddly enough, the Chinese state has placed or is seeking to place stricter controls over private actors' ability to collect personal data, including, say, facial scans or other kind of biometric identifiers. However, the Chinese state doesn't place really any limits on the ability of police or other security actors to collect information. So police are very able to go into communities and collect data from from whoever they want for whatever purpose they want. But ultimately, I think the aim of both systems is to get to that same endpoint. And that endpoint is data on everyone, which they could then potentially comb through and make use of for whatever purpose they see fit.
So what I hear is a lot of power from a minority as we know it, but how can we resist the rise of techno-fascism?
So I think one of the things that's quite central to fascism is that it's centered on exclusion, hierarchy, and contempt for difference. And so if we're thinking about what our response needs to be, well, our response needs to embrace a politics of inclusion, a politics of equality, and ultimately a politics of respect. Now, I think it's often, in my mind, as someone who studies politics, and maybe isn't as digitally savvy as many of your listeners or previous guests, my sense of what the responses are often might strike you as kind of simple, not really focused on technical solutions. But I really think one thing that is central to any resistance to fascism, be it in North America, Western Europe, or anywhere else, is actually a politics of tolerance, and specifically a politics where we are expanding our sense of solidarity. Fascism really thrives in environments where individuals or communities are identified as outgroups. They're identified as groups who are not deserving of the same rights or benefits as other groups. And one of the ways that fascist movements succeed is they often build upon or try to strengthen existing feelings of resentment or existing feelings of unease towards certain groups of people. Again, it could be migrants, members of the LGBTQ community. It could be people who have mental health issues, people who are poor, the unemployed, etc. So if we're looking to resist fascism, I think what we have to do, if not for principled reasons, then just for purely interests of for self-interested reasons, is to really recognize that we have a lot to lose if we aren't willing to stand up and defend those people who are fundamentally unlike us. So be that migrants, even undocumented migrants, be that people in our community who are homeless or addicted to drugs, people with serious mental health issues, people who have criminal records, members again of different racial, ethnic, religious communities who are unlike us. The idea there is not it's not the idea that you need to be friends with these people. You don't need to include them within your social circle. But when you're going to the ballot box, you're looking who to put your support behind, right? You want to throw your vote behind someone, or you want to put your support behind someone who is not trying to separate you or divide you from those individuals. Because ultimately, fascist movements start with them. They start with the groups that are already despised, and then they're going to come after other groups. I think the other thing, too, again, this may seem simplistic, it may seem naive, but people really need to take part in democratic systems, particularly in elections. Democratic systems are imperfect. They have often failed to prevent the rise of fascism. However, despite that being the case, I think a response cannot be cynicism. It cannot be a rejection of electoral politics. People need to enthusiastically participate in elections at the local and national levels. And I say this not in the sense that people need to be incredibly supportive of any particular politician or any particular political party. I think people don't need to look at voting as a strategic act. When you put your ballot in the ballot box, that's not a pure reflection of your politics, right? It is a when you're casting your vote, that is a temporary tactical decision to favor one candidate over another candidate. And specifically, either favor a candidate who addresses most of your core concerns, or on an even more fundamental level, give your vote to a candidate who's best placed to defeat a more odious candidate from taking power, including one on the far right. So for centrists, for political centrists, that means that in some cases they should be willing to throw their vote behind left-wing or far-left candidates. If those candidates are best suited to prevent fascists or say ineffective candidates from taking power, centrists need to be able to or willing to throw their votes behind those left-wing candidates, even if on a broad level, there's a lot of stuff that those far-left candidates talk about that they don't agree with. Likewise, I think leftists also need to be willing to plug their noses and vote for candidates, centrist candidates, who might have a better chance of winning against the far right. Now, I say this, though, not to say that politics begins and ends at the ballot box. It doesn't. As I said, it's a tactical decision in that moment to support one candidate. You vote for that candidate, but it's not a blank check to back them. It means that both before and after the election, no matter who wins, social movements, the press, ordinary people, they need to keep pressure on their representatives in government and others not to cede ground to fascists. Again, this kind of stuff sounds quite simple, this embrace of solidarity, this idea that we have to try to find
We
a kind
need
of common.
this.
We do it.
Simple but efficient, yeah.
I think we do. I think we do because this is how fascism works if people check out of the political system. If people aren't willing to go to the ballot box to put in their ballot and again plug their nose and maybe vote for someone who they otherwise wouldn't support, that is potentially, if they're unwilling to do that, that's potentially one more vote effectively that's going to the fascists. If people are unwilling to grant people in their community who are different from them in their gender identity, their class station, their interactions with the criminal justice system, their possession of a house. If people are unwilling to grant those people humanity, that's the kind of intolerance, that's the kind of bigotry that fascists play on to further divide people from other people. So fundamentally, I think the real resistance to fascism just comes from embracing liberal democratic norms while recognizing that they don't always work. Democratic systems are often flawed. They often fail to do the things we want them to. But embracing that because it really is one of the only institutional checks we have against a fascist movement, which, as I said, is often not even that popular, right? And also embracing that common humanity, recognizing that in order to stop fascism, we need to want to protect the rights of people who otherwise we might have nothing in common with. We may not even want to have coffee with these people, but they're deserving of rights, they're deserving of protection. And again, if those people are marginalized, if they're targeted by the fascist movement, there is no stopping the movement from coming after us or anyone else.
I love finishing an episode on such a hopeful note. Emil, thank you so, so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Saving money on your next painting project with Menards. Get a paint that combines gorgeous color and durability. Dutch Boys Platinum Plus is a paint and primer with a protective finish that guards against scuffs, spills, and stains. Get $15 off instantly and a single qualifying purchase of $100 or more on Dutch Boy and Purdy products. Now through March 8th. Plus, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for more great deals happening now. Save big.